Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. State Department releases its annual report on human rights practices around the world.
The State Department human rights report that was released today gives the U.S. government yet another chance to say, we know what's happening and we will hold those that do these grave human rights abuses and atrocity crimes accountable in our policy.
U.S. forces train West African troops to counter the growing terror threat in the Sahel region. Severe drought displaces millions in Somalia. Nigeria's ruling APC makes gains in the latest results from Saturday's governorship elections. Yesterday's nationwide shutdown in South Africa leaves deserted streets and closes businesses.
Today, there is no big mall, there is no small mall, no shop, no factory, no school, no nothing. It's open today. All of them are closed.
We are here from a member of the Economic Freedom Fighters. And Doctors Without Borders takes HPV vaccine to primary school girls in Malawi. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In its annual report on human rights practices around the world, released yesterday, Monday, the U.S. State Department looked at violations and abuses in 198 countries and territories for 2022. The study, which is based on what the U.S. calls credible reports, is required to be submitted to Congress each year. The State Department highlighted what it calls massive death and destruction during Russia's war against Ukraine, accusing Russian forces of committing war crimes and other atrocities. It also reports cases of abuse and violations in Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Sudan. Nicole Wethersham is the Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C. She tells viewers Carol Van Dam that while the report is thorough, the U.S. has not done enough in terms of following up on cases of rights abuses and violations with action, especially regarding the military rulers in Sudan who staged a coup in October 2021.
They have worked out an agreement that we're going to see the details of very soon that keep them in power. And it puts them on a transitional track to civilian leadership that, call me a cynic, but I've worked on Sudan for over 20 years. The devil will be in the time, in the details. They're only committing themselves to transitioning themselves out of power. Now, they transitioned once out of power, and then they took it back in a coup in 2021. So there's no clear path to having any of these abusers stop being in power that has led them to the ability to conduct the abuses. There's all impunity across the board in Ethiopia, in Sudan. South Sudan has worked so effectively to basically dissolve something they agreed to, the hybrid court on war crimes, to hold themselves accountable and to stop the cycle of impunity. And so all they want to talk about is reconciliation while the violent abuses continue. And those that oversaw the abuses in the South Sudanese government still stay in power. And they talk kind of illustratively about an election where they'll also transition to civilian power. And everybody just keeps these things on the horizon. And we're setting up the same path for Sudan. You commit now to having a transition to civilian government through elections at some point, some arbitrary date in the future. And you continue with these abuses and impunity and control over the economy and everything else.
What would Human Rights Watch like to see happen in those kinds of incidences with South Sudan, Sudan, Ethiopia?
The State Department Human Rights Report that was released today gives the U.S. government yet another chance to say, we know what's happening and we will hold those that do these grave human rights abuses and atrocity crimes accountable in our policy. So there's a whole variety of tools that they can do that. They can do that with sanctioning individuals. They can put travel restrictions on individuals. They can freeze bank accounts if any of these individuals that are committing crimes hold their money in U.S. dollars anywhere. They can keep certain U.N. mechanisms and do the diplomatic spade work that we create a diplomatic coalition that keeps these U.N. mechanisms that monitor human rights, like in Ethiopia and elsewhere, in place. So we continue to expose the truth, and the U.S. government's at the forefront of that. There's things that they can do with they're a permanent member of the Security Council. They can look at the U.N. levers and tools, and they can really marriage and institutionalize the information they know and the abuses that they're documenting by the people that they're working with into their regional policies and their foreign policies on these countries.
That was Nicole Withersham, Human Rights Watch Washington Deputy Director and Africa expert. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. U.S. forces are training West African troops to counter the growing terror threat spreading from the Sahel region. Meanwhile, security experts say Burkina Faso and Mali have essentially fallen to terrorist groups, meaning the U.S. and security partners are now looking at containing the Sahel conflict rather than stopping it entirely. Henry Wilkins reports from Sogakopa, Ghana.
Troops from Morocco and Ghana get ready for an over-the-beach raid as part of Flintlock, the annual US-led military exercise in West Africa, which this year took place in Ivory Coast and Ghana. A soldier from the Ghanaian Special Boat Service, who declined to be named for security reasons, described the exercises.
It's been 2 weeks of intensive training, and some of the areas included mission planning, visit board seizure and search, VBSS, tactical site exploitation. Yeah, we did sensitive site exploitation.
One of the US officers running the exercise hinted that Ghana had a big role to play in security efforts, as a long-running conflict with groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State militants spread to the north of coastal West African countries.
We are concerned, of course, with the terror threat coming from the north. And Flintlock is absolutely about pulling our partners together to help protect against that threat. I think from the international community, we're really focused on Ghana. Ghana is a center of stability and real capability in coastal West Africa.
Analysts say U.S. security efforts are shifting focus from landlocked countries to the north, like Burkina Faso and Mali, to coastal West Africa. The Burkina Faso and Mali governments have struggled to halt attacks and military advances by militant groups, leading to instability in both countries. Asked whether the conflict against terror groups in Burkina Faso has essentially already been lost, one expert replied,
I think to a large extent we can say that. I mean, there's still a government in Mali and there's still a government in Burkina Faso and they still control some areas. But I think the reality is that large portions of the populations in these countries are no longer under government control.
Annalise Bernard of Strategic Stabilization Advisors is a former advisor to the U.S. Department of State's Bureau for Conflict and Stabilization Operations in Niger. She told VOA that the U.S. appears to be increasingly looking to contain the terror threat from the Sahel instead of trying to prevent it.
I do think that a version of containment is going to start to take place at a more aggressive level, wherein we start to fortify the northern borders of those coastal West African states that I mentioned, ensure that all the other coastal states also remain as strong as possible, but keep our key alliance in Niger.
Analysts say that the U.S. is paying more attention to the Sahel conflict as great powers like Russia and China begin to show more interest and influence in the region. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited the Sahel last week to pledge support, while Vice President Kamala Harris is due to visit Ghana later this month. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Sogakope, Ghana.
In Nigeria, the ruling All Progressive Congress Party, the APC, appears to be making gains in the latest results from Saturday's governorship and state assembly elections. This, as the Independent National Elections Commission, INEC, has declared the results from Adamawa State polls to be inconclusive. Joining us from Abuja is journalist Medina Dauda of VOA's Hausa Language Service.
The latest in the governorship election results in Nigeria shows that Adamawa, the home state of the former vice president and the presidential candidate of the PDP, Atiku Abubakar, has suffered a setback because we were expecting the results sometime yesterday evening. Unfortunately, what we got was that the tight race between the incumbent governor Ahmadu Fintiri and Senator Aisha Tahiru Binani has been declared inconclusive. And apart from that, there's another state that is following Adamawa, which is Kebbi State. That state is also declared inconclusive, which means of the 13 results that we have, 2 are inconclusive.
Why did INEC, the Elections Commission, declare these elections inconclusive?
Well, what we got was that there are some local governments that had some problems. More than 40 or thereabout polling units were suspended, and then the results of that local government could not be collated. So what they did was to suspend the entire declaration of the election results. That is why they called it inconclusive.
As things stand, how many races have been declared so far, and which of the two leading parties, the PDP and the APC, would you say is winning or is in the lead in terms of the governor's count?
Well, one thing that I think will be of interest to you and our listener is that the ruling APC has pulled some surprises in the governorship election that was held on Saturday, 18th of March, because so far, APC is leading in its winning streak as it retains Katsina, Jigawa, Yobe, Lagos, Kwara, Gombe, Kaduna, Nasarawa, and Borno states. That makes nine. And then it reclaimed Sokoto state, and it won in Ebonyi and Benue states, which means APC alone has 12 states so far.
What can you tell us, Medina, about this suspended Roman Catholic priest who has won the governorship election in Benue State?
The Catholic priest who won the governorship elections in Benue State, Reverend Hyacinth Alia, was suspended from public ministry in the year 2022. That was last year, for getting involved in partisan politics. The suspension was by the Bishop of Boko Catholic Diocese, Most Reverend William Avenga.
Medina, it's a pleasure always to speak with you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, James. Have a great day.
That was journalist Medina Dauda of the U.S. Hausa Language Service speaking with us from Abuja, Nigeria. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 21st. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Streets in South Africa were largely deserted on Monday and shops closed as citizens heeded calls by the Economic Freedom Fighters Party for a national shutdown. The EFF is demanding measures to end the constant power cuts, job losses, and continuing economic hardships. It also wants President Cyril Ramaphosa to resign following a scandal in which millions of dollars hidden in a sofa at his farm were allegedly stolen. Tuso Kumalo reports. From Johannesburg.
The leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, EFF, Julius Malema, told protesters gathered near the offices of President Cyril Ramaphosa's union buildings in Pretoria that the stay away was very successful. Most eateries, shopping malls, and major businesses shut their doors in all major cities in South Africa, bringing the economy close to a standstill. A few people were in town, however, roaming the streets or visiting the few open shops. Malema criticized those who said it was business as usual, saying they expected violence and looting, but the EFF delivered a peaceful shutdown.
Today, there is no big mall, there is no small mall, no shop, no factory, no school, no nothing. It's open today. All of them are closed.
In the Johannesburg business district, many streets were empty and businesses closed. Simpiwe Stambu, a resident of Johannesburg, spoke to VOA and expressed full support for the national shutdown.
I'm not at work just because of the shutdown, but everything seems to be okay. There's still peace. There's no violence yet.
Businesses also came to a standstill in Pretoria, and resident John Mutwene told VOA that citizens are not happy at all about how the country is being administered by the president.
He promised people a lot of things. He said he promised job for young people. He promised everyone
better life, but none of those things are happening in this country. So Cyril Ramaphosa is the man without his weight. So Cyril Ramaphosa must go.
South Africa is currently facing economic difficulties with many jobs on the line. The power cuts have seen some citizens going for up to 12 hours without electricity. Meanwhile, the government has vowed that the thousands of soldiers and police officers deployed to maintain peace and order during the national shutdown will remain on the streets till April. The government and those who sought to interdict the national shutdown, including business leaders, have yet to respond on the impact of the nationwide protest since Malema said it was going to end at midnight today. Reporting for VOA News, I am Thuso Khumalo in Johannesburg.
In South Africa, the opposition Economic Freedom Fighters Party is vowing to force President Cyril Ramaphosa to step down before his term officially expires. This after launching a nationwide shutdown protest on Monday, demanding the president's resignation because of the recent theft at his Palapala farm, corruption in public institutions, high youth unemployment, and load shedding. President Ramaphosa put the military on alert, saying the EFF is attempting to overthrow his administration. For more on the shutdown, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Mpile Mautwe, a parliamentarian and a treasurer general of the EFF party.
Our reasons for demanding Mr. Ramaphosa to step down is because mainly of the Palapala farm scandal, where the president stashed dollars in between his couches and sofas, which were never declared, which he, by the way, confirmed himself that indeed he had those dollars in his house, in his farm, and those dollars were then stolen. And what he also did, he took the state machinery, the police helicopters and the vans and the police themselves to go and hunt the alleged perpetrators by himself without having notified the police or opened the case of theft at the police. But also one of the reasons why we want Mr. Ramaphosa to resign is because under his presidency, we've seen high levels of unemployment. We've seen high levels of inequality. We've seen high levels of joblessness. Our people are landless. They don't have the land. They don't have, when they are employed, they are underpaid at work.
But Ompile, how feasible is this demand for his resignation, and what are the prospects that he will resign after all these attempts to have him resign and he has refused to do so?
So remember, we are launching a campaign that makes everybody aware that there are these issues. Remember that Mr. Ramaphosa is a sitting president, so he doesn't only use his majority in parliament, but he also uses his power to suppress and sort of censor information. I mean, you've seen how the public protector has protected the sitting president. So the SABC, for example, they give out information that they deem fit. So our people, some of our people, they don't get the information correctly. So this campaign has actually led to everybody asking, what exactly is the EFF fighting about? The EFF is fighting about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now the society knows that Mr. Ramaphosa has done this and this and this, because if we keep quiet, the issue of Palapala farm will die down. And once it dies down, we'll forget about it, and Mr. Ramaphosa will never be held accountable. So we want to invite the society at large to say, come join us as we fight.
Ompile, how long is this shutdown going to last, and is this sustainable?
It is sustainable. So we've launched it today, and only today, the few days that the police have been deployed and the military, it has cost the state 166 million rand. Just, let's say it's 3 days of deployment, 166 million. Imagine, Peter, if we were to hold this for a week, it will cripple this economy. It will never be affordable for Mr. Ramaphosa. And the investors and business people of this country will say, but we can't sustain this thing of yours. Resign. The people are not happy with you. Another reason why we're taking it to the streets, which is, by the way, our democratic right, which is enshrined in the Constitution of South Africa, is that every time we take platform in parliament, they tell us that you are 44 member part in parliament and therefore keep quiet. So we wanted to show them the strength and the magnitude of the people on the ground, ordinary South Africans who are frustrated. And that is why you saw us going even to businesses, to approach businesses, churches, everywhere, all sectors of the society. We engage them in what we call stakeholder engagement, so that we are all on the same page. There is no negative narrative that people are spreading out there about the EFF.
Mpile Mautwe is the parliamentarian and the treasurer general of the Opposition Economic Freedom Fighters Party in South Africa. She spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty. As the Horn of Africa enters its sixth failed rainy season, the number of internally displaced people in Somalia has reached an all-time high, with millions forced to leave their homes. Abdul Kadir Dubeir visited a camp for the displaced in Dolo, Somalia, and has this report as narrated by Salim Salomo.
Sheltering from the scorching sun under a tree with her three children, Marian Ali Aden is waiting to be given a temporary place to stay. Aden was forced to leave her home in Waji district of Somalia's Bakool region.
The problem that brought us here is that we lost our farms and livestock to the severe drought. Their father used to bring us some food, but it wasn't available anymore. And after we lost everything, we had to flee.
Aid agencies such as the UN's International Organization for Migration, or IOM, say the town of Dolo, near the Somalia-Ethiopia border where Aden arrived, is seeing an influx of people fleeing the multi-year drought that began in 2020. This is Laden camp for the internally displaced, home to more than 180,000 people. IOM says it has added three displacement camps to house more people. Hassan Mohamed Gabo is with the International Organization for Migration.
As you can see, 15 families have arrived in these three new camps in 2 days. And the number of people arriving is increasing every day. We ask donors, the government and businesses to reach out and assist these people as soon as possible. Otherwise, the situation will get worse.
The IOM has also built a camp for the displaced in Barwao. A mother of seven, Faduma Ali Ado, lost one of her children on the perilous journey to the camp.
I fled from my home after the drought hit our farm and we lost all our animals. We walked for 7 days and I lost one of my kids on the way here. The only animal we brought here was a donkey. Then we sold it to buy food for my children. They have given me this house I live in now.
IOM's Deputy General of Operations, Ugochi Daniels, visited a camp in Baidoa and says the impact of the drought is widespread.
Baidoa has received the most internally displaced people in Somalia, but all of Somalia is also affected by conflict as well as by climate change.
The UN says the number of displaced people in Somalia has reached 3.8 million people this year. While humanitarian assistance is reaching some parts of Somalia, aid groups say immediate and sustained intervention at a large scale is required to prevent further displacement and a loss of life. For Abdul Ghadir Zubair in Dolo, Somalia, Salim Salomon, VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, March 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Porter in Washington, wishing you will have an amazing Tuesday.
Women and girls have just as much right to access the digital world and prosper as their male counterparts, according to UN Women, who say they remain underrepresented across the creation, use, and regulation of technology as they commemorate International Women's Month. Our voices will examine how digital innovation and technology can be used to set women and girls on a path of success. Join the conversation Wednesday at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sikus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.